everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Plowman's Folly right after this. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." And that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin, but public business is conducted in commercial paper. Paper like stocks and bonds and Federal Reserve notes and credit cards and debt and usury. Back in 1965, our Congress said that there is no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and that of clad coin and the currency. And you know, that is true when we're dealing with banks, government, and in commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of that gold over paper money, and there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper money versus the gold and silver. Now, you know, God and our founding fathers didn't give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for you and I to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. These politicians knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order to subjugate us, a free people, they would first have to take away our gold and silver coin in order to take away our property rights and to destroy those property rights. Now, if you and I intend to regain those rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me teach you how to do just that. Now, our business school is now on compact disc for adult homeschoolers. Now, for more information about my private business school, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free. And you can call right now and order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, the business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, again, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been reviewing the book that's entitled Plowman's Folly. It's kind of a self-explanation, the title itself, Plowman's Folly. It's a folly to plow. All farmers plow. I'm a farmer. I plowed. I stopped, but I used to. I was broke into the business plowing. One of my first jobs was to plow a 20-acre field for Frank Rocha, riding on a John Deere D model tractor, a 1947 D model with iron wheels. God, it was fun. I was 15 years old. I was at the pinnacle of my success as I was watching the ground turn turtle. Well, Edward Faulkner took a look at this back in the 1930s, since he was an agronomist and since he was the son of a farmer who was the son of a farmer, going back to the 1880s, and he said that as a boy he could remember the fertility and how it had declined. I'm an old man now, and I can remember the fertility, and I can remember the number of wells in the Eel River Valley and the number of people that irrigated in 1950, and then you take a look today, and everybody irrigates. So from very few people irrigating to everybody irrigating says, well, things have changed. And I always thought, and I made this report on the aquifers here a couple of weeks ago, and I said, you know, I thought that those aquifers recharged themselves. And they do. But we're pumping the water out at a greater rate than the aquifers can recharge, and so that's an Achilles heel. But until I read Faulkner's book, and I did this when I was just a teenager in ag school, in high school, and that was that the moldboard plow was the nemesis of agriculture, and I brought that to the attention of my ag teacher, and he kind of smiled and said, well, you know, that's just another theory that's out there, you know, it's something for you to consider. Well, boys and girls, if it's just something for us to consider, then it can't be very important. If it's something that's monumental, if it's very important, then all of us ought to take cognizance of it. Now, Faulkner here, I haven't read every chapter to you, and I haven't got the time to read the whole thing, but I can tell you that Faulkner did a field test back in the 1930s in which he rejuvenated, oh, I think it was 7 acres. 7 acres in 7 years. It isn't that you can rejuvenate 1 acre a year. You could rejuvenate 20 acres this year and 20 acres next year, or you could do 100 acres this year and 100 acres next year. I mean, but he took some of the poorest land, and I wanted to emulate this, so I took our parking lot. Back 20 years ago, we had a parking lot down below the house. And I took the parking lot where not even weeds would grow. And that's where I put our garden. And today I have 6 raised beds down there. And I went down to feed the chickens down there last night. And the grass is growing in those raised beds. I'm going to have to go down and cut it now, probably today or tomorrow, in order to keep it from going to seed. It's way ahead of the grass anywhere else on the farm. And that's because I practice these principles here in Plowman's Folly. And I located and I rejuvenated a parking lot and turned it into fertile ground. Now, of course, I've been working on it for 20 years, but it didn't take 20 years to rejuvenate it. It probably took about three years. So I know from personal experience that Faulkner's experiments work, and they're correct. And I wanted to share with you this last thought, you know, one of the chapters in the books, which deals with this thing of exit pests, because people ask me all the time, say, well, you know, if you didn't have sprays, you know, and DDT and whatever all these sprays are, I don't even know what the hell the sprays are. We don't use them here. We use birds here to control insects, but the insects don't multiply where the soil is healthy. We've got a lot of unhealthy soil all around our garden. So there's plenty of breeding ground here in the unhealthy soil, in the unhealthy plants that are all around our garden. I pointed out to you last time that we used to have 2 feet of topsoil here, but it's all washed away with the loggers. You know, they came in here in the 1880s and 90s and early 1900s and clear-cut all of this, took all the timber off, opened the soil up to erosion, and eroded it all off. It's all gone. It's down at New Orleans today. You people down in Louisiana have our topsoil here. So we've got to rebuild our topsoil. So I've done it in my raised beds, and I'm working on a grander scale now. I've got a farm here, and I'm working on the whole farm trying to rebuild the soil. And I did it in my garden area, and I told you the last time, I could feed 20 people off of my garden, 20. I can feed a family of 6 off of 6 raised beds. A raised bed, 6.5 feet by 60 feet, will produce all of the food that one person can eat in a year. All right, now that's pretty surprising, because you may be living in downtown Los Angeles or Cleveland or Philadelphia. You know, most of you people listening to me have already been removed from the land, and you're now locked up in the city. and you're totally dependent upon the supermarket system and your government and welfare and food stamps and so on. And in the event of a crisis such as world famine, and you can't get food, did you know that you could produce enough food for your family on your backyard lot? On your backyard. If you're living, you know, in the suburbs where you've got a third of an acre or something, I mean, you know, you're in Fat City, but I'm talking about you people. If you're in Cleveland, Ohio, and I happened to be there not too many years ago, and I visited a fellow there, and he's got a small house. I imagine it's 1,500 feet on a lot 50 by 100 feet, which is about typical, 50 by 100 feet. That's 5,000 square feet of lot, land, in the city. And take 1,500 feet now, isn't very much ground. Your lot doesn't take very much. Now, if you take 1,500 feet off of your 50 by 100 foot lot and allow your sidewalk and walks and one thing or another, this guy had a garage in the back that took up a little more on the alley and it took up a little more ground, but he easily had room there for 2,400 square feet of garden. 2,400 square feet. Hang on. See if I can eliminate that static. Now, 2,400 square feet in the Rodale scheme of things, 2,400 square feet is a pretty small garden. I mean, many of you people might think 2,400 square feet is humongous. But the Rodale people took a third of an acre, and they produced $28,000 worth of produce using French intensive culture on that ground. $28,000, that's pushing $90,000 an acre. Now, that's experimental, and it's experimental conditions, and it's intensive, and it's done by professionals who know what they're doing. But I want to point out, boys and girls, that your family is only using about $5,000 worth of food a year out of the supermarket. So if Rodale can take a third of an acre and produce, you know, $28,000, you can take a lot and put in 6 raised beds and use these principles that we see here in Faulkner and rejuvenate that land. I don't care how bad the land is where you're at. I mean, your subdivision may be built on an old lake bed or in a desert it's irrelevant. The key, remember, here is organic material. You've got to bring in some organic material. You've got to go buy some horse manure. Or you've got to go collect leaves from the neighbors. You got to buy a shredder and shred this up. You can buy straw down at the, you know, you can get straw for about $1 a bale. I think I bought some big bales of straw here the other day for $3 a bale. And the straw is available. You can get wheat straw or you can get oat straw, any kind of grain straw, and bring that in. You can run it through your shredder, chop it up, put it on that ground, mix it in, stir it in, just like Faulkner's describing here, and you can rebuild that soil. I don't care where you're at. Any place. Sahara Desert. You can do it on clay. You could do it right on top of concrete. And that's what I've got down here, because 9 inches below the clay that's underlying my garden area down here is solid shelf rock. I mean, it's just solid rock. I got 9 inches of subsoil, which is pure clay. It wouldn't grow weeds where we parked our cars. I put on top of that organic material, and I've been mixing it in over the years, and I've got nice black soil, grows anything. And there's no insects. No insects. And here's the results that you get from this. The hypothesis that environment influences plant disease and insect damage isn't new. In early agricultural literature, writers generally accepted the theory that the better the growing conditions for plants, the less the risks from disease and insects. From 1910 to the present time, however, it's been difficult to find this theory expressed in writing on agricultural subjects. It is true that the era of soil depletion has been contemporaneous with the period in which diseases and insects have become most troublesome. This could be true, of course, without being significant, but there are very good reasons for supposing a connection does exist. Many farmers can remember when there were no Colorado potato beetles, San Jose scale, and other insects and blights that are now common. These same men can remember also that at that time their plows separated a zone of almost black upper soil from the yellowish subsoil. This black topsoil has now disappeared, and at the same time many new insects have made their appearance, and those that were present before have become much more numerous. Plant diseases have multiplied in number and increased in virulence during the same period. And we may well ask then, is environment, meaning the soil, a factor in their control? And I want to tell you from personal experience, that's exactly correct. When I was a youngster, and probably 13, 14 years old, I left home and I went to work for an old guy named Russell Harvey. And Harvey was a gardener. He was an organic gardener. He didn't subscribe to the new theory that came about after World War II called chemical agriculture. Now, there was a, right after World War II, there was a path to follow. We could follow Faulkner's path, organic agriculture, and let's rejuvenate the land naturally through organic material, or we could take the chemical track. Well, everybody in the agriculture business, and of course the big corporations that were making these agricultural chemicals, were out there advertising to the farmers, advertising to you and me and everybody else, as a matter of fact, but mainly to the farmers, to use chemicals. The chemicals were cheaper, easier, faster, and produced better results. And short term they did. But these chemicals require irrigation. They require more water, and so in order to get more water, you couldn't get enough out of the rainfall, so you had to poke into the aquifers to do that. Worked like a shot. It's worked for 50 years. And we've gone through the green revolution around the world, and now the world is dependent upon the aquifers and irrigation, chemicals, and hybridized seeds. We had to take that route in order to feed the increasing population, because when I was born back before 1940, the population of the world was 2.5 billion. Today it's 6.5 billion. It's tripled in size. Tripled. Now, there's three times as many people, so we had to produce three times as much food, and so we needed to get after it, and we did. And chemical agriculture has been the miracle that has made it all possible. But remember, it's got this Achilles heel built into it. It's got the Malthus problem. And that is, it ultimately is going to collapse because the aquifers are going dry and the soil is being depleted of its organic material. Plants do not grow out of pure minerals. They have to have some organic material. Now some guy's going to write me a letter. Now he's going to say, yeah, you dummy, you don't know about hydroponics. Okay. Yeah, I know about hydroponics, and I know about Similac and breast milk, too. And that, in the final analysis, if we lived on hydroponics without any organic material, you will be so vulnerable to the insects outside that your hydroponics won't work. So you've got to use chemical sprays to kill the insects. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. And that's because the insects eat sick, weak, unhealthy plants. That's their design mechanism, and that's what they do. So the more chemical you put into the plant, and the less organic material that you use to raise the plant, then the weaker the plant becomes, the more useless it is for food. But the insects love them. And the insects eat them up. So in order to get rid of the insects, you got to use chemical sprays. Now you get into a cost bind here. Up in Washington, back in the 30s, they started using sprays on the apples. They used arsenic spray. The arsenic accumulated in the soil until it made the soil sterile and all the trees died. So they discovered that arsenic spray wasn't going to work, so we had to have something different. So they came up with more chemical sprays like DDT and other sprays along that line. And they work like a shot, and they can spray once a year and kill all the bugs. And then they discovered they had to spray twice a year, and then they discovered they had to spray four times a year. In some cases, now they're spraying up to 14 times a year. That's about once every 2 weeks. Well, pretty soon you'll be spraying every week. Already the cost now is getting to the point that you can produce these apples over in China and South America and other places cheaper than you can with all these sprays, dyes, and chemicals. Now that's what your problem is. Now somebody's going to write me a letter and say, yeah, but if everybody in the world is depending upon these food supplies that are dwindling, they won't be able to ship them here to the United States. Hey, you're starting to get the point. Not only will the prices go up, but the availability will go down. And remember, we're pumping our aquifers dry. So the only solution long-term for the maintenance of the world's population is to go back to organic agriculture. But you can't go back to organic agriculture because there's a great loss of production in the period of time that it takes to rejuvenate the soil, about 7 years. And the world cannot go through that withdrawal for 7 years to get back onto a more productive agriculture. Now, organic agriculture is actually more productive. It produces more bins and bushels per acre of food that is filled with vitamins and minerals. But when we came to that fork in the road in 1946, we decided that that fork in the road had too many potholes and too many problems, and we didn't want to spend the time, effort, and energy, so we took the easy paved road to chemical agriculture, the exact opposite. All right, now, we're at a new junction in the road. That road took us down to this juncture where the aquifers are going dry, the organic material is used up, and the population is three times what it was when Faulkner was writing his book back during World War II. Now, certain human and animal diseases and parasites have long been thought as being environmental. Hookworms belong entirely in the South, particularly in the southeastern section of the United States. Malaria can occur only where the Anopheles mosquito is present. Pellagra and other so-called deficiency diseases have usually been thought of as belonging to certain localities, and it's not been difficult to connect such troubles with the environment in which they've been found. Well, in recent years, the control of deficiency diseases has been much improved in most areas because of the more general availability of protective foods. Coincident with this improvement, however, there seems to have been a general decline in the nutritive value of foods produced on average land. The discovery of vitamins has brought this matter into sharper focus. When knowledge of vitamins was new, it was thought that certain foods contained an abundance of particular vitamins. Egg yolk was said to be rich in most of them. Now it's known that the vitamin content of the egg yolk is seriously affected by the food that is consumed by the chicken. Butterfat was considered to be uniformly potent as a source of vitamin A. More recent discoveries, however, show that the vitamin content of butterfat or cream is largely dependent upon whether or not the cow has access to a quantity of grass or to the richly colored foods which provide her with this essential vitamin. Neither the hen nor the cow can by herself create the various vitamins that she transmits to the consumer of her products. The vitamins must be supplied to each animal through the food that the animal consumes. All right, now, not only is that true, it's an Achilles heel again, because the weaker the soil becomes, then the poorer the plants become, and the poorer the plants become, then the poorer the animals that live on the plants. Cows, by the way, are all vegetarians. Well, that isn't exactly true anymore, because now we feed them bypass protein in order to raise that protein content. That's another story for another day, and that's where mad cow disease comes from. But let's understand a vital principle here. Nutrition begins in the soil, and the soil nutrition is dependent upon these processes called land sabbaths. We call it green manuring or fertilizing the soil. You can do it in other ways. I'm not saying that you have to practice land sabbaths in order to fertilize the soil. I'm saying that in order to maintain soil fertility, though, you've got to practice land Sabbaths on a field scale in order to do it on a national scale. Now, we can do this artificially and individually, you know, on a lot in downtown Cleveland or Los Angeles. But if you're going to do this to 9,000 acres of wheat land up in North Dakota, you're going to have to practice land Sabbaths or something on a similar scale. Now, getting back here to the nutrition, let's think about it pragmatically, because you go into the Safeway store and you buy a gallon of milk. You bring it home, you drink the milk. You presume that this milk is filled with vitamins and minerals and has all the nutrients that you need, and you don't think very much about that. Well, I'm here to tell you that those products that you're buying out of the supermarket are deficient in those nutrients and foods, and that's why you have to take these multiple vitamins every day. And if you don't, which most people don't, but if you don't, then you become deficient in these products. You know, for instance, if you're drinking the milk out of the supermarket, which comes from the cow that doesn't have the vitamin A in her milk, then you're not getting the vitamin A. Your body doesn't produce it. The cow's body doesn't produce it. It's produced in the plant that the cow eats. And now, if this plant that the cow eats, that's the alfalfa, that's being raised out here in Tracy, California, let's say, on chemically fertilized land, which is becoming more and more nutrient deficient because it's being abused by plowing and other chemicals and sprays and so on, then the vitamin A isn't in the alfalfa, so therefore the cow doesn't get the vitamin A, and therefore when you drink the milk, you don't get the vitamin A. And so when you don't get the vitamin A, you've got a deficiency disease, and your cells go into spasms, and they develop cancer, and then you come up with cancer, and then you go to the doctor, and the doctor puts you in the hospital, or he puts you on chemotherapy or something, and, you know, that costs a lot of money, and that's why you have to buy health insurance. Now, there's a solution to this problem. You know, I mean, you don't have to be a real smart person to figure out that we need a solution to the problem. And the solution isn't going to come from Monsanto and GMO seed. And it isn't going to come from the local dairy farmer over here who's buying his hay from some other farmer who's growing that hay and selling it in the food chain. It's not going to come from the commercial salesman who's selling the chemical pesticides and so on to keep the insects off the alfalfa. Those people don't have a clue. They couldn't find it at high noon with both hands and a roadmap. But you and I, if we put our minds to the problem here, we can solve it. And remember, I've said, if you don't have a solution to this problem, boys and girls, then you don't need to listen to the problem. So you got to have a solution to it. And the solution is, if you want healthy, nutritious food, you've got to go to some guy that's raising it organically, or you've got to grow it yourself. And that's just where reality's at. Now, there's another school of thought, and it says, well, let's go ahead and eat the foodless food, and we'll take what we can get out of it. And then we'll take vitamins. We'll go to the health food store, and we'll buy vitamins to make up the difference. Well, that's a good point, and it's better than nothing. But I think it's second or third best. I think getting the organic vitamins and minerals out of the food itself is the natural God-ordained methodology, and you'll probably live longer and happier and have less disease doing that. And if you can't or don't want to, well, then I guess you can eat foodless food and take the vitamins. And then you should probably carry a health insurance policy right along with it because, you know, there's always a possibility to pick up a little disease in the process. Let me give you a little reminder here at the midway point. And we'll be back with more on exit pests from Plowman's Folly when we return. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, that's what we're on right now, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log scheduled and archives, and that can be accessed through the webpage. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, history, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct, to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we do give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily 100% endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. And if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Talking about Edward Faulkner's book, Plowman's Folly, Exit Pests, there's a definite connection between sick plants being grown on sick soil and insects. Now, these disquieting discoveries that foods that we had thought were always richly endowed with health-giving substances may themselves be deficient in certain instances have shifted attention to the plants, which normally would be expected to supply these vitamins to the animal. So it becomes a complicated chain of cause and effect. Milk, cow, hay, grain, or grass, and back to the soil. In other words, the blame for any deficiency goes back in the last analysis to the soil. So when we discover that during the very period in which deficiency diseases are being decreased in the localities where they have been most serious, the area in which they occur seems to be widening. So in the past few years, certain of the deficiency diseases have been found in places where they were unknown before, and at the very same time, we find that the soil, that's life's ultimate source, has declined sharply in its ability to nourish properly the plants upon which we depend. Characteristically, Americans confronted by this dilemma of deficient foods have turned to the drugstores to buy vitamins. There's very little doubt that the development of synthetic vitamins has served to postpone disaster for many people. But it seems unnecessary to pay for something whose value is yet wholly unquestioned, when by properly modifying the environment in which our plants live, we can again build into our food plants all the vitamin richness that they once had. The logic of such a viewpoint is inescapable, and yet it has not been investigated officially to determine whether it may be true in fact. Now, we have experimental data to prove the necessary causal relationship between the completely nourished cow and the milk that is rich in vitamins and other nutrients. Hang on a second. once in a while, that static gets the best of me here. We know through experiment that only food, that is, good feed, in correct proportions and quantities can nourish the cow properly. So we're just as sure, with ample experimental proof to sustain us, that only a soil that is capable of supplying a sufficiency of plant nutrients in suitable combinations can create foods richly endowed with the elements needed to produce human or animal health. We have, in other words, all of the necessary elements of logic for reasoning from the good soil to the best of health, or from poor soil to the direst of disease, in the animals and those of us who consume those products. They all come from the soil. But we have not assembled those elements into the necessary whole to arrive at the logical conclusion, at least not as a nation. Our agricultural reasoning is in much the same condition as was the passenger transportation of the country before the existing railway lines had been grouped into great transcontinental systems. We should be able now to take the entire trip from starting point, good or poor soil, to the terminus, that's good or poor health, without having to make all of the local stops in between. Now remember, Faulkner's writing this during World War II, when we're dealing with more experiments and experimental evidence. Today, the evidence is all in. We're all grown up people. We went to college, remember? Got letters after our names. We all know this. That's why we take vitamins. You know that the foods that you're eating out of the supermarket are deficient in nutrients, and so you take vitamins to make up that difference. Now, at some point in time, that breaks down. That's where the Infamil and the Similac come in. Modern American mothers came to the conclusion that they didn't want to breastfeed their babies. Breast milk, ladies, just in case you didn't know, has 107 constituent properties to it. I mean, that's a complex stuff. 107 items. Now, read the label. Next time you go in the supermarket, pick up this infant formula and read the label. And they brag about the 12 essential vitamins and minerals that your baby needs. Then they don't tell you about the other 95 essential vitamins and minerals and nutrients and proteins and enzymes and all kinds of little thingies that's in here that was designed by God and put into breast milk to nourish that infant. They don't tell you about those 95 that aren't in there. No salesman does that. Salesmen brag about the product. They don't brag about somebody else's product. So I just wanted to point out that natural milk is a better product than anything that we've been able to concoct as a replacement. So that being said, if you want to breastfeed your baby, that's the most logical. It's the cheapest. It's the best way. And if you don't, well, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success, but when you produce this skinny, sickly, undernourished runt, then you'll know what the cause was. Now, similarly, if we eat out of the grocery store, we turn into sick, weak, undernourished runts. So don't be surprised if you're wearing glasses, or you need a hearing aid, or you have allergies and you sneeze a lot and your eyes run and you've got some other diseases and symptoms, you know, like diabetes and so on. Those are the symptoms that come from nutritional deficiencies. You know, if you need 107 things in your milk to make you healthy and strong, if you take any one of those out, then there's likely to be some kind of a repercussion, don't you think? I mean, just test it. Get in your car, you know. Take out just one spark plug. Just one spark plug, that's all. Your car has 14,000 parts. What the hell is one crummy part? One spark plug. Now start it up and drive down the road. And you'll hear this hissing, loud noise coming out of the hood. The car's running. It works. Hell, you can drive it to work. It's just that it doesn't run as good. While you're at it, why don't you take the gas cap off and throw it away? It isn't going to affect the operation of the seven-cylinder car. But, you know, over time, there are probably some contaminants that may get in to the gas tank, which may affect its performance in the future. Now, I've noticed that people are careful to put their gas caps on and make sure they change their spark plugs every now and again. I haven't talked to anybody recently who pulls a spark plug out and throws it away and says, this is just a vestigial appendage of the automobile, which is no longer needed in the evolution of automobiles, which are moving from 8 cylinders down to 6. I haven't talked to anybody like that. You know, people aren't that stupid when it comes to mechanics. They seem to get real dumb, though, when it comes to nutrition. I have observed people are smarter mechanics than they are nutritionists. So, I think that your baby will do better on those 107 elements in your breast milk, lady, than they will on the 12 elements that are coming out of the Similac, although the kid will probably survive on that Similac. I've seen many of them do that. I mean, I've been watching, you know, for a long time, and I, you know, there's all these problems that come in between, you know, like sudden infant death syndrome. Nobody's ever been able to find a baby, and this is the last that I've heard this story. Nobody's ever known of a baby on breast milk to die from SIDS. It says it sends a signal to me. It says that probably the sudden infant death syndrome comes about with formula. Probably has a lot to do with vaccinations and 15 other things that go along with it, you know, but I'm just putting that out to you that just can't beat good nutrition. So I raise all my calves on the cows. Now, of course, you know, as a commercial dairy operator, I can readily understand that there'd be great confusion, you know, when you bring in 500 cows, you know, into the corral and there's 500 calves in the corral with them. And you're trying to run these cows, you know, through your herringbone barn, and you've got all these calves, you know, running around, and those cows are circling around trying to lick their calves, you know, and it just, I don't think that would work very well in a commercial settlement over here, but it works all right with me. For instance, I've got 2 cows down here, I have 2 calves, and I just leave the calves on the cows. And the calves, they just suck all the milk that they want out of the cows, and then I bring the cows up and I separate the calves from them up here in the corral, because I only got 2, see. I mean, you can separate 2 calves from 2 cows in the corral. I've never tried to separate 500 calves from 500 cows and then do that a couple times a day. That seems like to me to be a lot of work. So I separate the calves from the cows. I bring them in the barn. God, they love it. And I feed them alfalfa pellets, you know, or I give them a little grain, and they love it. And then I sit there, and I take the rest of the milk. I take what the calves can't use. And my calves are great, big, healthy pigs. They never have the scours, and they're just as healthy as they can be. I wouldn't waste my time trying to nurse a damn sick calf off of a bucket. I guess American mothers don't have anything better to do than to take their kids down to the pediatrician every week and spend a couple $100 or $100 and buy all these prescriptions and load their kids up. Hell, in this country, we got kids that are healthy. Those are the kids that have ADHD or ADDD or something like that. We used to have recess in school. Today, they give them drugs to calm them down. And I guess, you know, if you got plenty of money, you can do that. But one of these days, that's going to run out, and one of these days, there's a day of reckoning. So I just thought I'd share with you this information so that maybe you could avoid that. Well, Faulkner goes on, he says, now in my test work, and subsequently in my field work, I discovered that soil conditions seem to be factors in the extent to which plants are affected by diseases and insects. Okay, I'm going to pause right there and make my little mark here in the margin. I've made the same observations here in the last 20 years, starting about 1986 through 2006, where I built my raised beds on the parking lot down there. I notice I have no insect or disease problems down there in my garden at all. None, zero, zilch. I don't have any insect or disease problems with my calves. Of course, I let them have all 107 elements in the mother's milk. I'm not trying to feed them, you know, some concoction that some scientist developed in a laboratory at Monsanto. so that I can save some money and send off another gallon to the creamer. I figure if you want to raise good cows, good calves, you give them good food and you get a better product. And it works like a shot. Works like a shot. Next, the evidence was so convincing that I watched carefully for verification of the idea in commercial crop growing when the tests were repeated on a field scale. So he tried his scales like I did down here in a garden scale, and then you take it out here into the field. And I've been emulating this guy over here. Works great. Works for me. Worked for him, and I think it'll work for you. The results in the field fully confirmed my earlier deductions, and I'm sure that the existence or non-existence of plant diseases in certain fields is related to the condition of the soil, and that the incidence of insect damage is likewise related. God, I can't contain myself. They put another little mark in the margin over here. I noticed the same thing in my field study. You know, I'm an old man now, and I just kind of experiment. I don't need to farm to make a living anymore. But I discovered that you can get more and work a whole lot less by emulating the biblical principles in the 15 agricultural laws that we find in the Bible. In other words, the Bible has a system over here whereby you can get maximum production with the least amount of work. And farming is the most profitable enterprise ever created by the mind of man or by the mind of God. Let me repeat that. I know it's so revolutionary, and all you farmers are sitting out there with your mortgages and your PIC programs, and you're on the ragged edge of destruction, economic destruction, farming. I have farmers, they come to school here all the time, and they want to know how they can file for bankruptcy. They want to know, what can I do to get out of farming and move into the city so that I can get on the gravy train like everybody else? They want to get out of farming. They want to get into banking or insurance. Now, banking and insurance are good businesses. I don't decry banking at all. It's the second best business ever created by the mind of man or God, and insurance is right behind it. And then followed by medicine and cancer and, you know, so on down the line. But get your pencil and paper out here, boys and girls, and let me show you how profitable this agriculture is. Agriculture. Can't be beat by banking. Banking has about 1,000% markup, as I recall. I worked out the numbers one time. I think it's around 1,000. But farming has an 87,000% profit, in 87,000% profit. Now, boys and girls, if you got a business that produces 87,000% profit, what do you have to do to destroy the profitability and go into bankruptcy? Can you figure that one out? You got a business that's so profitable, you got an 87,000% profit return on your money. What do you have to do to bankrupt that business? You got to go into paper money, borrowing, and violate the 15 agricultural laws of the Bible. And farmers do that. See, farmers are scientists, and they're modern, and they're up to date, and they go to ag school, and they get degrees after their names, and then they come back out here and put chemicals on the ground. And they use GMO seeds, and they use hybrid seeds, and they never let the land rest, and they never practice land Sabbaths. I mean, just on and on it goes. And they go broke. They go broke. They can't farm and make money. All right, now here's what it is. You take one kernel of corn, just a kernel, just one. Not hundreds and thousands, just one. Take that kernel of corn and go out in your backyard and put a little hole in the ground about 3 inches deep and stick that kernel of corn down in that little hole about 3 inches deep, about 2 inches probably. Well, hell, they ain't even that much. Just bury it 1 inch. 1 inch. That'll do. And cover it up. Put a little water on it. Step on it so that you can get the capillary action. Just step on that kernel of corn. Now, just go away and leave it alone. Just get the hell out of the road. And you'll find that one kernel of corn is going to grow, and it'll produce a plant, and that plant will grow, and the plant will grow up and up and up. And I got ahead of myself. You got to take two kernels of corn because we got to have some cross-pollination here. Excuse me, boys and girls, you got to have a little cross-pollination. Well, you could do it. You could take two kernels of corn, plant them about 6 inches apart, and you get two of them growing up together. And now you'll make 87 and 87. Hell, you'll make 87,000% twice. Okay, now the kernel of corn grows and it produces this stalk, and on this stalk will be two ears of corn, two ears. And then when these two ears of corn mature, they'll be about a foot long, and they'll have 16 rows of seeds on them. And they will produce 436, I believe it is. Yeah, 436 kernels times 2. 2 sixes is 12, 2 threes is 6, 1 is 7, 2 fours is 8. That's 872. Now, you take 1, and then you divide that by 872, and that'll give you 87,200% return. You got that? Hell, even you bankers out there with fractional reserve banking and all of your thefts and all of your chicanery can't produce a profit like that. Now, that's in corn. Now, you know, there's berries and there's, you know, there's other plants out there you can grow. And get this, God produces the soil to start with. So you come onto the soil and you didn't have to make that or create it or produce it. It was already there. And then God produces the sun and the rain for photosynthesis, and he invented the corn plant. All you have to do is take one kernel of corn, take a stick, poke a hole in the ground, stick the kernel of corn in it, and then step on it. Just push it right down to complete the capillary action and get the hell out of the road and leave it alone. Can you do that? Well, that's what Faulkner did over here, and it worked like a shot for him, and I tested it, worked like a shot for me. And the Rodale people tested it, and they got $28,000 on a third of an acre. Now, that's, you know, I admit that's experimental test plot scale, but hell, all you need is $5,000 worth of food and produce off of your little 2,400-foot operation over here. And the more organic material that you have in the soil, the less insect problems you're going to have. The less. Now, I got another little trick that I do over here. I feed the birds. You see, when farmers spray, they kill the birds. When you use chemical fertilizers and sprays and chemicals, it kills the birds, and the birds are eating the insects. Now, there's a natural balance out there. And the insects are out there for a reason. When you see insects out in your garden, those insects are your friends. They're not your enemies. They're your friends. And farmers have made enemies out of the insects, and they don't understand the biologic process here. And Faulkner does. Remember this book now. It's Plowman's Folly. The author's name is Edward Faulkner, F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R. Published by University of Oklahoma Press, 1943. You'll have to get it. It's not going to be in print today. You're going to have to get it at a used bookstore. You'll have to look for it. But the insect is your friend, not your enemy. And here's the way that works. The plant grows. And where the roots of the plant are going out into the soil, if there's a deficiency in that soil, let's say there's an iodine deficiency, which, by the way, causes goiter. If you have an iodine deficiency, you develop this goiter. It's not fatal. I mean, you know, just take a spark plug out. You got 8. Just take one out, throw it away. Car will run. Just because you got a goiter, you know, doesn't mean that you're going to die. The body runs. It just doesn't look as good, run as good, smell as good, or perform as well, that's all. So anyway, say there's some iodine deficiency there in the soil, and the roots go out, and they can't find any iodine, so the plant doesn't have any iodine in it, or it has a deficiency in iodine. along comes this corn borer. You know, he's just marauding around looking for something to eat. And he's sniffing the air, you know, kind of like a coon, you know, in heat. And so he's sniffing the air. And so he looks around, and my God, he smells something that really is good. And so he goes into these corn stalks, and he starts looking around. And he finds this ear of corn that is deficient in iodine. And it smells real good, and it tastes real good. So he gets in there, and he eats it. And when this corn borer eats this ear of corn, you know, he doesn't eat the whole thing. He just gets in there and messes it up real good. And so that when you peel it back and you see that, you say to yourself, oh, ugh, God, that is gross, and you throw it away. That's the design mechanism. God didn't want you to eat it because if you ate it, it's deficient in iodine, and you won't get enough iodine. You'll get goiter. It won't be fatal, but it'll be kind of, you know, unsightly. Might not even feel good. I don't know. We used to call that Adam's apple. But it used to be pretty common. When I was a kid, a lot of people had this iodine deficiency. They had Adam's apple, they called that. And they would talk, and this lump, you know, in their neck and their throat, it would go up and down. So it was kind of fun to watch, sitting at the table, you know, watching some guy with iodine deficiency talk. You know, you could watch his Adam's apple jump up and down. And so we looked at that, and we said, oh, my God, we got to do something about that. And so we started putting iodine in our table salt so that we could eliminate that. It's just a trace mineral. It's pretty deficient here in the Midwest. It'd be more common, you know, if we had better soils, but, you know, we're not likely to make any changes like that. And so you can just carry that on out. You can do it with vitamins and minerals. You know, if you're lacking in vitamin C, you get scurvy, and if you're lacking in vitamin A, you get something else, and if you're lacking in this mineral or some trace element, selenium, for instance, you develop cancer, and you get bad eyes if you don't have enough vitamin A. You know, you can't see as well, and so on. And so those are the choices that we have, and then God comes along, and he says, now, I'm going to create these insects over here to protect your health. Insects are there to protect your health. And the insects are so good at it that when farmers don't practice land Sabbaths and the other agricultural laws of the Bible, then the penalty that they pay is that the insects come in and eat up this bad food, this corn, and destroys it. So the farmer says, well, I don't want that. So he gives God the finger, and he goes out to commercial man, and he picks up these chemicals and sprays, and he sprays it and kills the insects, which are the natural barometers to protect us and to protect our health. And then he feeds us this food which is deficient in these nutrients, like iodine, so then we get Adam's apple, and we don't fire on all eight cylinders, and we wonder why. See how simple that is? Remember, the book is called Plowman's Folly. Plowman's Folly. By Edward H. Faulkner, Faulkner. I think you'll be glad that you took the time to read it. Do another step further and actually put it into practice, and you'll make a lot of money, and you'll save a lot on your health insurance premiums at the same time. All right, we're about out of time, boys and girls. We've got to leave it right there, so let me remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.